Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to open with a team from the Connecticut Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, who recently presented a summer symposium on prisons and mental health. We're going to hear why the subject was so compelling for the CHRO to examine in depth and learn how each of the symposium panelists played a role in developing the information that attendees received. Then we're going to turn to a research specialist at Food and Water Watch, who's going to discuss a brand new report that gives our state a D grade when it comes to developing renewable energy resources that are actually healthy and good for our environment. Would you believe that Connecticut is counting the incineration of trash as a clean resource? We're going to find out how that can happen. And then we're going to close with the director of the Child Guidance Clinic for Central Connecticut, talking about how they're applying a first of its kind in the state therapy system to help children suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. This summer, 211 Connecticut is offering a summer webinar series on a variety of topics. It's already in place and continuing through Wednesday, September 5th. 211 Connecticut is hosting weekly webinars that are free and open to the public. They include Get Connected with United Way of Connecticut 211, Food Resources in Connecticut, Connecting to Substance Use Resources through 211. 211 Counts Online Data Dashboard, how you can help update the information on the 211 database, and resources, tools, and supports for older adults. Each webinar will be approximately 30 minutes and include a live demonstration, and it'll allow time for questions. All sessions will be recorded and made available on the agency's outreach and training page, and if you'd like more information and a detailed description of each webinar, visit 211 Connecticut's Summer Webinar Series page at 211ct.org. Well, sadly, we hate to decline invitations, but this one came just a little too late to make. So I made a commitment to our guests on the air this morning, Cheryl Sharp, who's deputy director of the Connecticut CHRO, the Commission for Human Rights and Opportunities, her intern, Yuna Liu, and her colleague, Michelle Demas-Kuehler, that I would touch base with them after the fact so that they could help all the folks that are listening throughout Connecticut and our listening area this morning learn a little bit about the work that they did on July 25th during their annual summer symposium, which this summer focused on prison and mental health in Connecticut. So we're going to start with Cheryl. Cheryl, thanks for joining us this morning.
Sure. Thank you for having us.
So this is an annual thing. What was it? And we should let folks know that we may be handing the phone around to the three parties this morning. So don't be thrown if it sounds like we're handing off to someone for a moment. But Cheryl, from your perspective, when the ideas were being battered around as to what direction you were going to steer this summer's symposium in, what was it about prison and mental health that kind of made that the focus point?
It's an important area, and mental disability is one of the protected classes that is covered under our statute that we enforce. And so I had a group of interns, and every summer Michelle and I work with a group of interns, and they do a summer symposium. And we were working on a documentary that we've been working on called Life After Imprisonment. And it deals with housing insecurity for individuals who've been in prison, the disparity in the criminal justice system, and the difficulties in getting employment. And so the interns, one of the interns who's a part of the group of young people who worked on this project, was working on the documentary film. And so when they came and sat down and presented prisons and mental health, and also introduced to us the proposition that mental health is a huge issue within prisons, and a lot of mental health care is happening in prisons as opposed to in hospitals, we thought that since it is one of the protected classes covered under our statute, it was a timely topic, one that should be dealt with. And in Connecticut, the prison population is being driven down through a lot of the work of the current administration. And so we wanted to explore, as the population of imprisoned people gets smaller and smaller, what's happening with the mental health issues that are out there that these individuals are dealing with while incarcerated and once released.
Very good. Well, one of your keynote speaker, I should say, has been a guest on this program before, Dan Barrett with the Connecticut Division of the American Civil Liberties Union. He's the legal director, and he was your keynote. What were a couple of the points that he made that seemed to resonate both with you and with the audience?
One of the key points was that mental health is an issue, and while in the state of Connecticut, the prison system wants to have best practices and has some best practices put into place, that there are still a lot of issues, and that the imprisoned population is dealing with, you know, post-traumatic stress, and that there are victims on both sides of the issue, and that we can do better than we're doing now. It was, I thought, a good that he did point out that there have been some strides made in Connecticut, and that it appears that someone is listening. Commissioner Semple, who sat on the panel, certainly tried to address a lot of the concerns that Santos Colon, who was also a panel member from Emerge, who had been in prison, some of the issues that he raised, he tried to address them. And then I think it was really good to have the ACLU shape the conversation for us, which is why the Una and the rest of her team of interns chose him to be the keynote speaker. They have a lot of latitude we give them to put the program together, to do the advertising of the program, to shape the issues. And, of course, Michelle and I approve everything and make sure it's within our mission and it's something that we cover. But certainly their hard work and thinking about the topics and conducting the research, all of that was done by the interns.
Yeah. I thought it was also interesting that you not only had Scott Semple, the commissioner from DOC, on, but also Dr. Burns. Craig Burns was the chief medical health, is the chief medical health officer for the Connecticut Department of Corrections. I bet they provided some really good kind of balance, where Scott has to kind of look at the big picture. Dr. Burns is more hyper focused on the issues, including the mental health issues of the folks in the system.
Yes, and I thought Dr. Burns added a lot to the conversation. We wanted to have a balanced panel. We wanted to have someone who had used the system and had been imprisoned. We wanted to have social service advocates, and we also wanted to have the State of Connecticut Department of Corrections, so that we could hear all sides and so that the audience and our agency could have a really thoughtful and fruitful discussion, because we didn't want to just talk about the issues. We wanted to try to look at some of the solutions, and we wanted to have a real conversation about what was happening in the prisons and how it was being perceived by those individuals who were imprisoned. And so there was a portion of the discussion that got heated when we talked about solitary confinement, and one of then Santos indicated how many days he had been in solitary confinement and the mental torment that he felt that he had experienced while being in there. And then Commissioner Semple actually, in a gesture of humanity, said that he's sorry that he had that experience, because Santos indicated it was a 72-hour solitary confinement. And then Commissioner Semple, you know, said that he was sorry that he had an experience that caused him mental anguish, and that they were looking at their facilities and how they provide their services, and that their intent was to make sure that the prisoners leave in a better position than when they actually came in. So I thought that that was a good, healthy discussion and debate that went back and forth. And, of course, Dan Barrett from the ACLU chimed in and said in the best-case scenario or best practices was what he thought the commissioner and Dr. Burns were describing, but not all circumstances are best case scenarios, and so that the issue certainly needed to be discussed further, and there needed to be additional solutions that as a collective body that we came up with.
Excellent. Tell us more about Emerge Connecticut and how that organization ended up yielding not just Mr. Santos, but also Alden Woodcock, who's their deputy director. Why was it important to have the voice of Emerge Connecticut on this panel?
And so I'm going to pass the phone to Una because she worked on getting Emerge Connecticut and Great. Can talk about the importance of having Emerge there.
Great. Una Liu is an intern with Deputy Director Sharp's office at the Connecticut Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Hi, Una.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for joining in on the conversation. As you were hearing one side of it there in the room with Cheryl, she put me on with you just to hear a little bit about your thoughts behind inviting Emerge Connecticut to be a key role in this panel.
Yeah, so one of our interns actually gave us the contact information for Emerge because back in June, we want somebody who has experienced the incarceration and who has gone through all this. And one of our interns just put us in contact with Alden Woodcock, who's the deputy director of Emerge Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So they are a nonprofit social enterprise that actually operates like a transitional employment program for returning citizens in New Haven. So they actually employ their participants. I think that gives the participants a chance to actually re-enter the society and provide them with means to provide for their lives.
Very good. From your perspective, we've got a couple minutes before we have to wrap up the interview, Una. As an intern, did you find that your very tightly integrated role in the process of putting in and presenting this symposium is going to be a huge boost to you in your career pursuits?
Yes. First, when we tried to put up the symposium, we wanted to instigate compassion in people's minds to actually moving toward a criminal justice reform. So I think I learned a lot from the symposium about like personal experience, about policy making process, and that actually helped me shape my understanding better about the topic about prison and mental health in Connecticut.
Very good. Well, it was great to speak with you for just a couple moments, Una, and thank you for your great work on this symposium and the assistance that you provided in helping arrange for us to chat this morning. Let's go back with Cheryl, if we could, just for the last minute or so that we have, and I thank you once again.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Hello.
Hi, we're back with Cheryl Sharp. She was deputy director for Connecticut CHRO, which we should really remind folks is the first agency of its kind in the nation here in Connecticut. So very exciting. And Cheryl, I did want to thank you for being part of the program this morning. We've just got about 30 or 40 seconds left, and we did leave out poor Stacy Pete from Norwalk Community Care. Could you just give us a quick little glimpse of the role that she played on the panel?
Sure. Stacy Pete talked about the at-risk Norwalk residents who suffer from chronic medical conditions and what happens to those individuals when they are incarcerated. She talked about the Fairfield County area and how unique the criminal justice system affects women and their mental health, and how the treatment that they can receive in prison can be of assistance, and the difficulties in dealing with people who are experiencing mental health issues in the community, like in in hospitals, and sometimes the hospitals don't know what to do. And those individuals, when they're repeatedly coming to the hospital, sometimes end up in the prison system. And she talked about the relationship between the prison system and her organization and how they try to assist people. So she really rounded out the panel, and that is what I would say her contribution was. And thank you for acknowledging that we're the oldest governmental civil rights agency in the nation. As we celebrate our 75th year, this is our 75th year anniversary, actually. So this is a good time for us to address, and we're trying to address all of our protected classes that are covered.
Very good.
And we have 27 of them.
Well, this is certainly reason to bring back some other folks from CHRO to further celebrate that milestone in the coming weeks or months as we move through 2018. But for now, yeah. Cheryl, we will need to say farewell, but I'll be back in touch and make sure that we are able to provide an even kind of better scope on what CHRO does on a future segment where we have a little bit more time. But I do want to thank you. Cheryl Sharp is the Deputy Director for Connecticut's Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. We also talked to their intern, Yuna Liu, and Michelle Demas-Kuehler was also assisting in both putting together the seminar we talked about this morning as well as this morning's call. The summer symposium for CHRO was involved prison and mental health in Connecticut. We just kind of heard a little bit about it, but we'll be back to talk more with CHRO in a future segment. So we hope you'll return back to help celebrate this milestone for this oldest organization of its kind in the country. And Cheryl, once again, thank you so much for your time and your colleagues as well. Well, now we're going to switch gears to the environment and speak with Patrick Woodall, who's a research director for Food and Water Watch and the Food and Water Action Initiative. A new report from Food and Water Watch reveals that Connecticut counts filthy, polluting energy sources like wood burning and garbage incineration as sources of renewable power. This evaluation is part of a broader study of 29 different state renewable programs that awarded report card grades for each state profiled in this new report called Clean Washing, How States Count Polluting Energy Sources as Renewable. So, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning. First of all, is this an ongoing type of study that just brought kind of Connecticut into the inventory of states that you're looking at? Or was this something that you and your colleagues at Food and Water Watch decided to mount from scratch?
Well, we mounted it from scratch largely because it was very difficult for people to kind of figure out what power sources were in their state's renewable programs, and there was little comparison between the states that had these mandatory renewable portfolio standards. So there are 29 states in the District of Columbia that have mandatory programs that direct utilities to buy a portion of their energy or generate a portion of their energy from renewable sources. So we looked at all 30 of those states and kind of assessed where they were, how strong was the goal, how many dirty energy sources were in each of the portfolios, and then we looked at where we thought they might be in 20 years with wind, solar, and geothermal energy alone.
So when folks kind of quickly hear in passing that Connecticut is utilizing a lot of renewable energy, I guess the concern is that while they say renewable energy, it may not necessarily mean clean energy, right?
Right. It doesn't mean wind and solar in Connecticut. Right now, only about 2% of or 1% of Connecticut's energy is coming from wind and solar alone. Most of it is coming from other sources. And Connecticut counts wood-burning power plants and garbage incineration and waste methane from landfills and sewage treatment plants as clean, renewable energy. But the reality is, while these things may be sort of nominally renewable, we're not running out of garbage, they're not really clean energy sources. Many have comparable or even greater climate and air pollution emissions than even a coal power plant. So that including these in the state's definition of renewable is sort of counterproductive. It's still increasing climate emissions, and it's delivering real air pollutants that have human health effects to neighboring communities.
Okay. So, there's also something in the report and in the advance that I received about renewable energy credits. Can you kind of explain to folks what that's all about and why there should be some closer attention being paid to the application of RECs when we're talking about renewable energy?
Sure. Renewable energy credits essentially allow utilities to continue burning fossil fuels, but purchase energy credits, renewable energy credits, from potentially even distant sources. And this allows companies to not change their energy mix at all and instead sort of invest in paper credits. This is part of the kind of trading notion where you could trade our way to climate protections. But the reality is that the real benefits of renewable energy are felt sort of locally. So when states use renewable energy credits, maybe they're buying the credit for something pretty far away, then the local community doesn't benefit from shutting down a coal power plant and putting up a zero emission generation source like wind or solar.
So I guess that leads me kind of backwards to what we just talked about before. If renewable energy credits are being purchased, is there some guarantee or any assurance that the credits are being purchased from entities that are burning or utilizing clean practices? Or can these credits be bought in another state with a company or an organization that's burning garbage or coal?
Well, generally, the states allow you to use a renewable energy credit for any power source that qualifies for the renewable energy program. So Connecticut could buy garbage incineration credits in another state. Hmm. And indeed, we have seen some states buy waste from paper mills and landfill gas and even garbage incineration from other states to fulfill their renewable energy credit, their renewable energy program.
Interesting. Connecticut and a number of its leaders have touted this attempt to increase their use of renewable energy, and I guess Connecticut's RPS program is looking for 48% renewable energy by 2030, with I guess the ultimate goal being eventually 100%. Looking across the 29 states that you surveyed through this Food and Water Watch report, are any or many of those 29 functioning much more successfully or ambitiously, not only toward around half renewable, but even pushing further than that and getting closer to 100?
So Connecticut this year increased its target to 48%, which was a good step, I think. We're urging states to adopt a 100% renewable energy portfolio system. But I think across the states, the thing that we've learned is that these programs can be effective, and they can be a very important tool for climate and energy policy for the states. But the key elements are to have a good target. You want to have a very ambitious target. We think that the urgency of climate chaos means that we need to really rapidly move to 100% clean energy. The states with stronger targets, states like Hawaii that has a 100% target and Vermont that has a 75% target, and also have a cleaner portfolio, generally seem to be the states that have seem to be on track to be adopting enough enough wind and solar energy that could be generating more than half their power within 20 years from wind and solar alone. We think with stronger renewable programs, this could be, go even higher and can really start to move a state on track to be delivering the enough renewable energy to help curb climate change.
I paraphrase something that your executive director, Winona Hauter, said in that we keep hearing that renewable energy sources like wind and solar are becoming much more prolific that as a result or because they're becoming cheaper than ever to build out these industries. It's economic development. It's creating jobs. So what's the difference between what we're doing here in Connecticut and what leaders are doing in states that are much more closely adhering to developing clean energy versus just renewable dirty energy?
So other states have portfolios that are less inclusive. So a lot of Connecticut has a lot of dirty energy combustion sources in its portfolio. Removing some of them would be extremely helpful. And, you know, renewable portfolio standards are an important part, but not the only part of a state's climate and energy policy. So other states are offering tax credits for people to put solar panels on their roofs or for utilities to adopt wind farms and things. You know, Connecticut, there's a huge opportunity for offshore wind in the Long Island Sound, and that is starting to come online in New York. So those are the kind of things that states are doing to incentivize the adoption of these renewable energy sources. I mean, last year, Connecticut cut a deal with the Millstone Power Plant to include that as one of its preferential purchases. So it's giving for renewable energy. So it was giving a nuclear reactor the same sort of access to procurement that Connecticut gave to wind and solar power. And that's sort of, you know, not the right direction. What you want to do is make sure that these incentives are directed towards wind and solar and geothermal and tidal energy that are the things that we need to really curb climate change.
Excellent. We're going to come back, folks, and talk a little bit more with Patrick Woodall. He's a research director with Food and Water Watch and Food and Water Action. Their recent report, Clean Washing, How States Count Polluting Energy Sources as Renewable, is available for you to view at fwwatch.org. And we're going to take just a couple moments and we'll come back and talk with Patrick a little bit more about this important subject. Stay with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Ambassador and Volunteer Program Manager at the Agency on Aging of South Central Connecticut is looking for volunteers age 55 and older to visit seniors or veterans or assist with organization of mail and bills in the greater New Haven area. They're going to provide the training and support. You provide the friendship and the time. Your hours will be flexible. For more information and to sign up for this program, call 203-752-3029. And to learn about all the services and opportunities at your regional agency on aging, call 211 or visit aoascc.org for the Agency on Aging of South Central Connecticut. We're back. Thanks for sticking with us. Patrick Woodall is on the line. He's research director with Food and Water Watch, which recently revealed that Connecticut is counting filthy, polluting energy sources such as wood burning and garbage incineration as sources of renewable power. Right before the break, we were talking about how they're including the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant in this initiative. This is Connecticut is one of 29 different state renewable programs that were awarded report card grades in this report from Food and Water Watch called Clean Washing, How States Count Polluting Energy Sources as Renewable. So, Patrick, Connecticut, as we saw, got a D grade. So help the folks that are listening to the program this morning understand how they might take steps to influencing a change in this direction. Among the 29 states in your survey, are there any who have developed or that have developed a great kind of symbiotic relationship between government initiatives and the people in those states to really, push much closer to 100% clean, even if they're only targeting a percentage of that clean energy use over the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years?
So I think there are some states that have done a pretty admirable job. And as I said, these renewable portfolio programs are only one portion of the mix. So a state like Iowa has adopted so much wind energy that it could generate enough power for the whole state within 20 years, just from wind alone. And states like California have been doing similar things where there's a bunch of initiatives to encourage the adoption of wind and solar and to encourage community-based solar programs and rooftop solar and things like that. And those are great initiatives, and they can work together. I do want to provide a little bit of clarity. The Millstone Reactor is not part of this renewable portfolio program, but the state of Connecticut did offer a procurement agreement to Millstone last year that would give it comparable terms to selling to Connecticut as wind and solar got. So it's sort of a separate policy, but it shows that these things need to go together, that this is the renewable portfolio standards programs are one tool in the kind of arsenal of climate and energy policies that states have at their disposal. They include things like using tax credits and grants to encourage the adoption or development of clean renewable energy. They include creating preferences for purchasing, and that's sort of what Connecticut was doing with the solar and the Millstone last year. And they include these renewable energy portfolios, which direct utilities to generate or purchase renewable energy up to a certain target goal. And Connecticut increased its goal last year to 48%, which is in the right direction. It's one of the higher goals in the country, and that should help. And that should help Connecticut actually adopt more. The better another thing to do, obviously, people need to talk to their state legislators and their state senators, because that's where the action is on these policies. And Connecticut needs to clean its energy portfolio. That means getting rid of the eligibility for garbage incineration and wood-fired power plants, and to make sure that when the utilities are adopting renewable energy, they're really adopting clean energy, including mostly solar and wind, to ensure that the Connecticut residents get the benefit, not only from reducing climate emissions, which is obviously critical, but also in terms of reducing air pollutants from the emissions from the power plants that are often in disadvantaged communities.
Wow. Well, Patrick, tell us a little bit as we move toward the end of our chat today about the powers that are at play in the state houses across these 29 states, including in Connecticut. What industries or entities are lobbying to incorporate these dirty energy sources as part of this this package, where if people don't read the fine print, like in your Food and Water Watch report, they might just assume renewable is clean.
Right. I mean, this is sort of goes back almost 30 years to the 1970s when there was a recognition that oil and natural gas were finite resources, that they would run out at one point. And so the notion that we would have renewable energy really meant something that we had a sort of endless supply of, like wind and like sunlight. But it also turns out that we have an endless supply of garbage. So the industry actually promoted the use of things like garbage incinerators to generate energy, but also to deal with landfill waste. And when these renewable energy portfolio programs came on the scene in the 90s, Connecticut adopted its renewable portfolio in 1998 and just updated it. When that happened, the garbage incineration industry, which they call a waste-to-energy industry, they jumped on the opportunity to get their facilities, which are huge carbon emissions, huge air pollutants, far worse than coal power plants in terms of emissions per megawatt. They realized this was a golden opportunity for them to ensure that they had not only clean-washed their industry, but also got a steady stream of revenue by selling their power to local utilities. So those kinds of industries are at play at every statehouse across the country. The same is true with wood-fired power plants, and we see that the factory farm industry is promoting methane digesters to generate power that they are calling clean power, that they are really is just burning methane, which is no different than fracked natural gas. And so those kind of systems, those so-called biogas systems, are really just providing cover for the fracking and gas industry to build more pipelines. So those kind of interests are very powerful at the statehouse level, that they're, as we have seen in Washington now, the energy industry is extraordinarily powerful at the federal level, but they're also extraordinarily powerful at the state level. So those kind of interests jockey for power, and when you open up an opportunity like being able to call garbage incineration renewable energy, those interests are going to really knuckle down and get what they can out of the state legislatures.
So it's basically, I mean, to kind of put it bluntly, getting citizens motivated to essentially threaten to put their state legislators out of a job if they don't begin to adhere to clean standards when it comes to renewable.
I think holding our elected officials accountable at the local and national level is essential, and they need to know, the legislators need to know, that the citizens are watching, that they know that there are giant, dirty energy loopholes in these renewable energy programs, and it's time for the state legislators to close the loopholes, to increase the target goal, and to really get to expel dirty energy from the renewable energy programs in Connecticut and in state houses across the country.
Well, Patrick, I dare say that there's going to be a lot of people in Connecticut that are going to be moving in that direction, thanks to just the few minutes that you've spent with us on our program this morning. I certainly learned a lot, and I imagine this has been an eye-opening discussion for a lot of people that are listening to this program, and I very much appreciate you explaining it to the extent that you have. Folks, if you want to consult and read this new report from Food and Water Watch entitled Clean Washing, How States Count Polluting Energy Sources as Renewable, you can go to the Food and Water Watch website, fwwatch.org. Our guest this morning has been Patrick Woodall. He's Research Director for Food and Water Watch and the Food and Water Action Initiative. Patrick, great to meet you, and thank you so much for your time this morning. Well, we all know, and on this program, we've talked about PTSD and the effects it can have on folks in the military, those on the front line of combat, those that have experienced severe trauma, and sadly, children can also be exposed to some of these same symptoms within their own homes from a really early age. So we've got a special guest with us from Connecticut, but who we're talking to way out in Wisconsin today while he's traveling, who's really doing incredible work helping kids overcome PTSD. We're going to speak with Jim Mafid from the Child Guidance Clinic for Central Connecticut. Jim, thanks for joining us on the program this morning. Sorry to interrupt your vacation, but great and important work you're doing. Tell me about the kind of the beginnings of the Child Guidance Clinic for Central Connecticut and how this organization kind of steered its way toward working with children.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. So Child Guidance Clinic was founded in 1957. So we're in our 61st year. And we are a nonprofit social service and behavioral health organization that serves children, families, adolescents in both the home and also in our office-based settings. And the agency has evolved. You know, back in its beginning, it was really more funded by the state to help serve children and families that otherwise could not receive services. And then over the last 61 years, the agency has evolved, as has the social service arena. So now most of our clients are insured in some way, but we continue to get state funding, funding from United Way, from a local community development block grant through the city of Meriden. And so that funding, along with some direct payment from insurance companies, helps us provide the services.
And what, we, what kind of treatments and programs do you provide?
So we, our service array is both our outpatient mental health clinic, which is licensed by the Department of Children and Families as an outpatient psychiatric clinic for children. We're also licensed by the Department of Public Health as a freestanding substance abuse facility. So our programs range from the outpatient side. We provide psychiatric and assessment, psychological evaluations, and then traditional psychotherapy through master's level clinicians. And then on the community-based side, we have an array of services. One is an intimate partner violence program funded by DCF that goes into the home and works with both partners when there's been intimate partner violence, and it's designed to help strengthen the family, to help keep the family intact, and then minimize frequent or ongoing exposures of that violence to children. We have an early childhood consultation program, a parenting support service program that also goes into the home and provides supportive services to parents and their children, and then the Child First program.
So while you're called a child guidance clinic, it really sounds like you provide a very holistic and wrapping type of services for any of the family or caregiver members that might be involved in the in these traumatic and sometimes ongoing incidents.
That's correct. So we really see the family as, you know, kind of the core unit of a strong community, strong society. So we do, we focus and treat children and adolescents are the majority of our clients, but we're always also working with the parents and the adults that are involved in their lives to really help strengthen the overall functioning and understanding of what's going on.
What are you discovering about these children that are who are constantly exposed to situations that can actually impact them with clinical PTSD in their very own homes?
Well, there's certainly a lot of research tied in with early childhood development and exposure to trauma. So almost all of our programs are in one of some form of an evidence-based model of practice. So essentially, some prescribed processes that have research that back and demonstrate that we can get some desired outcomes. But with children and their brain development, we know that these early exposures to trauma can significantly impact their development. And so we want to intervene as early as possible just to help alleviate those symptoms and, again, help increase the opportunity for some strong emotional and cognitive development of the child.
What are some of the other types of situations that you have seen or are seeing in some of the clients and patients that you're treating that have triggered PTSD in the child?
So there's a variety of symptoms that children can start to exhibit. And so, you know, we always say to parents, you're the expert with your child and with your children. And so to stay kind of tuned into what they're doing. And if you see some things that seem off kilter a little bit, it's good to tune into them. But some of the symptoms could certainly be restlessness or with children, particularly when it comes to trauma or PTSD. They will typically act it out in some way through their play. And so just when one starts seeing that there's a repetitive pattern attached to certain themes in their play or restlessness, difficulty sleeping, social withdrawal can be another symptom. And when they're school age, certainly looking at both how they are at home, but also how they're interacting with peers and or in a classroom. And so it's really just important to keep our eyes open, because while there's a number of symptoms, and we certainly all may experience restlessness in our lives or sleeplessness, it's when these symptoms kind of cluster and start seeing a series of symptoms that then all relate and start saying, okay, this is more serious and probably would benefit from having some kind of assessment done. And that's something we can do at Child Guidance. Folks can call in. We triage and screen the information that's given to us, and then we help identify what might be the best program to help somebody seek additional services from. Mm. Early intervention is good.
Are young children so kind of impressionable and have such fertile imaginations that they can actually acquire a clinical PTSD diagnosis if something severe happened to someone they know versus something that they witnessed themselves?
I do think that if the repetition is what I'm focusing on, what you just said, so certainly that repeated exposure. So if somebody continually shared very traumatic, impressionable, intense experiences with somebody else over and over, and that was, let's say it's a sibling talking about something that's happening to them in a family, I think that could start to lead to some of the fear and anxiety and some other symptoms associated with trauma. But that certainly could be a form of trauma. You know, anything from a car accident could have an impact on one person one way and another person another. So even though there's exposure, each individual sometimes copes differently. So even though two people could have the same exposure, one may develop symptoms and one may not. And so it could be, again, like an automobile accident where there, you know, it was a very traumatic event, or walking back and forth to school where you're going through areas where there's lots of fighting or fear of gang violence or shootings. One person that could trigger much more symptomology in one person than another. So there's lots of ways that one interprets and internalizes kind of what happens to us in our lives. So in that family where there's intimate partner violence, one child may actually be more tuned into that than another child. Right? And so kind of individualized with each of us.
Yeah. We've also heard from other guests on the program that a lot of times a child that may witness something in a one-on-one situation may actually end up exhibiting that And so it's not necessarily admitted by the child?
Absolutely. An intimate partner, kind of what we see the most in our exposure are usually issues of intimate partner violence, physical, sexual abuse in the home. And yes, they absolutely may not show symptoms in one setting, but in another setting continually show those symptoms. And it could be a school teacher that just picks up on that. It could be a babysitter that says, you know, something is off here again. And again, I can't overemphasize that as adults, it's just very important to tune in to what seems to be a shift in behavior or that repetitive theme of, something is off from their normal behavior. And that play is suddenly becoming way more aggressive than it used to be, or when they're playing with their dolls, or, you know, they're doing things that appear to be harmful. And that was, you know, a change in behavior, and it wasn't just fleeting, that it continues.
Mm. Well, in the last few minutes that we have with you, Jim, and folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with the executive director of the Child Guidance Clinic here in Connecticut, Jim Moffitt. And what is exciting about your organization, Jim, is that you've got a first of its kind in the state initiative. Let's talk about the Child First program for a few minutes.
Yes. And so Child First has been around for a number of years. We've had it at Child Guidance Clinic since 2013, I believe. And it's a program, again, that's designed, it's evidence-based. It looks at early childhood development, the brain development. It's backed by research. And it's a team that goes in. So we have both a clinical person, a therapist, whether it's a social worker, family therapist, licensed professional counselor, and also a case manager. So we approach the work kind of twofold. One is to provide that clinical assessment, diagnosis, and again, it serves children up to 6 years old. So it's very early, early developmentally focused program. But then there's also a case manager that helps the family get connected to other services, other supportive services. It could also be just some basic needs types of services. So it's founded in making sure that the family's in a stable place and that their basic needs are also met so that they can then do some of that higher functioning, meeting emotional needs of a child. And so we have a team of five staff at our agency, and they do excellent work, and we're glad to have the program. And the program has also moved on to other states, so it's becoming more of a nationally recognized program.
Very good. In closing, can you offer any advice to parents, caregivers, or others who are in proximity to children that have been exposed to trauma and may, in fact, be clinically suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder?
My biggest recommendation would be if you're in doubt or you're wondering if something is up, to certainly seek and call, you know, some professional organization. Talk with your pediatrician, talk with your family doctor, express your concerns, or reach out to an agency like Child Guidance Clinic for Central Connecticut. If you call an agency, our agency, or any other agency like ours, we will be very open to hearing what's going on and help parents identify whether this seems to be something that's more benign and passing or warrants a little more assessment and diagnosis to see if there's a little more services that could be used. But we have families that, you know, call and they come in for a few sessions. We have families that call and they're not quite sure if something's going on. And then when they come in, they realize, yeah, this has been going on longer, and they suddenly, through a series of questions, realize, oh, there's other things they've seen that they just didn't connect to the puzzle, if you will. Mm. So I would always encourage a parent. I'm a father of four. They're older now, but certainly when in doubt, make a call, and the professional can help determine whether or not anything further is needed.
Yeah. And just to add to that, there is a significant difference between a brain being exposed to trauma as an adult than there is to the child. There's actual risk of brain development issues in a child that's exposed to trauma that's quite different than with an adult, right?
Well, because children's brains and certainly young children are developing so rapidly and so impressionable, that those early childhood exposures then impact further development. So they do affect an individual differently than an adult whose brain has been more thoroughly developed, if you will, due to age and maturity. So that's why we really want parents to just think in terms of anything. I always say exposure, we've had natural disasters and we've had 9/11 and images on that TV over and over and over. And so sometimes it's good to turn off the TV and just not let that impression be imprinted over and over and over. Yeah. And so talking with your child, being aware, being open to what they're sharing is very important. And then, again, minimizing exposure to things that could certainly provide an intense kind of emotional traumatic event to them would be good.
Very good. Jim Moffitt, our guest this morning, is Executive Director for the Child Guidance Clinic for Central Connecticut. If you'd like more information on this organization, particularly if you're kind of in the Central Connecticut area around Meriden, Wallingford, Southington, you can go to cgccentralct.com. That's CGC...
.org.
Oh, I'm sorry, .org.
I'm sorry. Yep.
Yeah, cgccentralct.org. For more information. Jim, enjoy the rest of your vacation. Thank you for taking the call from us this morning, and best of luck with the Child Guidance Clinic for Central Connecticut. I think we'll be talking to you again soon, so thank you very much. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.